content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled Born to Be Wild by Susan Frankel. Iridescent sweat bees, hairy-faced mining bees, tiny Perdita minima, the size of a gnat. Thanks to swarms of apiary enthusiasts, native species are finally getting the buzz they deserve. One summer day in 2018, Sam Droge lowered his net and scooped up a few small bees buzzing around the blossoms of a chinquapin, a shrubby member of the chestnut tree family. Droge, a wildlife biologist, can recognize loads of bees with a quick look, but these were strangers to him. It wasn't until he studied them under a microscope that he realized what he'd found. "Holy crap," he said to himself, "that's an Adrena raine, a bee that hadn't been sighted in nearly 100 years. Droge heads the United States Geological Survey Bee Lab in Beltsville, Maryland, which supports native bee research, inventory, and monitoring projects. He never travels without a net, preferably the one he nicknamed Philanthus after a type of wasp that hunts bees. Opinionated, funny, and idiosyncratic, he often wears his long white hair in Viking braids. For years, he drove a car rigged out to look like a dragon. A bee hunter for almost 3 decades, he is always on the lookout for new or rare species. He was pleased when bees drilled nesting tunnels in the walls of his straw bale house. For most of us, the word bee conjures the beloved honeybee that was brought to America by early European colonists. But native bees are very different creatures. They don't congregate in hives or make honey. Aside from bumblebees, most native bees live solitary lives and nest underground or in tree trunks, logs, plants, rocks, or other structures. And while honeybees have become the mascot for popular campaigns to save the bees, they're the wrong poster child, as bee enthusiasts, or beeple, as some call themselves, will tell you. Honeybees are domesticated livestock, like cattle or chickens. Though they've suffered diseases that have killed off colonies, they are in no way endangered. Native bees, on the other hand, have been on this continent for tens of millions of years, co-evolving with the native flora that need help to spread their pollen. That partnership birthed a dazzling diversity of creatures that come in as many in many sizes, shapes, and colors as the flowers they pollinate. Bumblebees, with their shaggy pelts, are perhaps the most familiar native bee. But there are brilliant blue osmia bees, race car red nomada bees, and iridescent gold-green sweat bees, so-called because they lick sweat. Carpenter bees can be bigger than a quarter, while some tiny Perdita bees are smaller than George Washington's nose on the quarter's face. Some native bees use long tongues to reach nectar in deep-cupped flowers. Some have hooked hairs on their faces to accumulate pollen grains from floral tubes. Oil-collecting bees have spongy hairs on their legs to sop up the floral oils they mix with pollen to provision their young in the nest. Squash bees go out early to catch squash blossoms when they open, while sweat bees in Texas forage at night to gather pollen from evening primroses. There are bees that clip circles from leaves to build their nest, and others that secrete a cellophane-like resin to keep their nest cells watertight. There are bees that drill nests into sandstone or hollow reeds or take over empty snail shells. 20% of native bees are kleptoparasites, which lay their eggs in other bees' nests, often leaving their young to feed on those other bees' young. All told, there are an estimated 3,600 different species of bees in the United States, more than in any other country in the world. While commercial farms rent truckloads of honeybees each spring to pollinate commercial crops, Native bees are the unsung heroes maintaining our food supply. They pollinate some 75% of our plants, both cultivated and wild. Indeed, some plants, tomatoes, eggplants, kiwis, and blueberries, can only be pollinated by native bees. These plants only release pollen when shaken. Certain native bees can buzz their muscles to vibrate the pollen loose, something honeybees don't know how to do. Like pollinators in general, though, native bees are in decline. Pesticides, pathogens, and diseases are partly to blame. But the biggest cause is habitat loss. The steady displacement of plants and open spaces by housing developments and highways, cities and shopping malls, farms and flowerless lawns. We humans wouldn't starve if all native bees disappeared, but our diets would be a lot more boring and a lot less nutritious. We'd be largely reduced to nuts, grains, and of course, honey. Yet when it comes to understanding these crucial cogs of life, says Droege, we're about 100 years behind where we are on plants, butterflies, and birds. That's in part because bees are hard to study. Even experts need microscopes and taxonomic guides to identify the tiny, often subtle features that distinguish species. Basic information about most species remains unknown. Their lifestyle, their plant preferences, the places they're found, the historic distribution. Without that data, it's hard to know which ones are in trouble or what measures are needed to protect them. Droege used to sign off his emails with the line, "How can you save the bees if you don't even know their names?" Bee. Only around 600 bee species have been formally assessed for their risk of extinction. As for the remaining 3,000, we truly don't know, says Saf Killingsworth, a conservation biologist at the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Many species haven't been seen in decades. And until recently, Killingsworth explains, there have been few efforts to systematically survey native bee populations. At the Xerxes Society, Killingsworth co-leads a State of the Bees initiative, which involves combing through the digitized records of nearly 2 million bee specimens in collection around the United States and Mexico to help establish which species are at risk of extinction and where and why. Meanwhile, a small army of beeple are working to collect and identify native bees and track the plants that bees interact with. Some are trained scientists, others are ordinary citizens with a love of bees. This is old-timey natural history, Leif Richardson, another conservation biologist at the Xerxes Society, says. In an era of molecular biology and genomics, people rely on old-fashioned nets and specimen jars. It's not sexy science. All it provides is the most basic information: what bees were on what flowers at a given location and point in time. But that knowledge is critical for parsing the status of native bees. When you combine millions of these records for thousands of species, you start to see coherent patterns in the data, Richardson says. Droege, 67, is a key figure among beeple. He's both deeply knowledgeable and uncommonly generous in sharing his expertise and the resources of his lab. He can talk high science with PhDs and woo non-expert audiences with wise cracks about how badass that bee looks. Over the years, he's inspired and trained scores of researchers working on behalf of native bees. He also maintains an email list with more than 1,000 subscribers, which is when he announced that he had found rare Andrena rainy bees. He urged readers to check chestnuts or chinquapins for the bee. To two friends who are particularly avid correctors, he wrote, "Get thee to a chestnut." Conserving bees starts with knowing what's there. And as the story of Andrena rainy shows, it often depends on knowing where to look. When Tracy Zarillo saw Droege's message about Andrena rainy, she had a pretty good idea where she could search for it. Zarillo is an entomologist at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in New Haven, which started efforts to breed blight-resistant chestnut trees in 1930. An invasive fungus known as chestnut blight, which famously struck billions of American chestnut trees in the first decades of the 20th century, killed the tree's trunks and branches, but not their roots, leaving the species in a biological limbo. They were not extinct, but they were mostly unable to rebound or reproduce. For nearly a century, researchers had been working to breed chestnut trees that can withstand the blight. One of those experimental orchards lay a scant 7 miles from Zerillo's office. She sent an assistant over to look for Andrena rainy bees. Lo and behold, there was a thriving population there, she told me. Well, thriving might be a stretch. Her first check in the summer of 2019 netted only 3 Andrena rainy off the dangly catkins of yellow chestnut flowers. In 2021, Zerillo did a more systematic survey of the orchard and collected 39 Andrena rainy, as well as 4 dozen other bee species. The next year, she broadened her search and found Andrena rainy at 2 other research orchards in 2 different counties. Some people have adored bugs since childhood, not Zerillo. She fell into entomology when she took what she imagined would be a short-term job as a research assistant at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. An early project had her raising maggots on green peppers. "It really turned me off peppers for a few years," she said. In 2009, the research station put her on a study investigating beneficial pollinators. Her boss suggested she take a course on bee identification with Droege. "I was just blown away by his excitement," she recalled. "He became my biggest cheerleader besides my mom." Zerillo, who was then in her 40s, went on to earn a master's degree in biology, focusing her thesis on wild bee communities in Connecticut. Zerillo has a low-key, cheerful manner and hair dyed the orange gold of a bumblebee. She's been running the entomology lab since her boss's retirement in 2022. The shelves of her office are stacked with white pizza box-like containers storing bees she's collected. Some are from a place called Robin's Swamp, a one-time cornfield that is being restored as a pollinator meadow. In 2021, the plot was filled with an array of native plants, including common milkweed, bee balm, ironweed, blue vervain, and monkey flower. Already, Zerillo had observed that some very important species, including 2 declining species of bumblebees, have found the meadow. Once the right plants are there, it seems the bees just show up. When I visited Zerillo at her lab last spring, she was putting the finishing touches on an overall inventory of Connecticut's bees. Many other states are doing similar projects. The last full inventory was conducted in 1916 by Henry Lorenz Viereck, a famed entomologist whose career was cut short when he was struck by a car while collecting insects beside a road in Ohio. As it happens, Viereck was also the first person to describe Andrena rainy in 1907. He named it after James A.G. Wren, who caught the specimen against which all others are compared in 1902. Updating Viereck's inventory was a monumental task. Zerillo and her colleagues combed through falling apart 19th century bee guides, looking for mentions of species found in Connecticut, a process complicated by frequent name changes as taxonomists lumped together or split species. They scoured some 40,000 records of bee specimens and collections, and more than 18,000 verified sightings on the common science site iNaturalist. Zerillo did her own targeted field searches for certain uncommon bees. All in all, she and her colleagues determined that Connecticut is, or has been, home to 385 bee species, including a dozen never before reported in the state. The inventory included 43 species that hadn't been reported since 2000. "The biggest problem for bees in Connecticut is habitat loss," Zerillo said. "Places that bees rely on to collect pollen and build nests are being chipped away from all sides, from development, from browsing deer, from invasive plants." One of the missing bees is Bombus affinis, better known as the rusty-patched bumblebee. Historically, it buzzed across eastern United States, extending south into Georgia and as far west as the Dakotas and into parts of Canada. Now there are scattered populations in half as many places. The last one found in Connecticut was a female collected at a pick-your-own fruit farm in Guilford in June 1997. The cause of the bee's sharp decline isn't fully known, but experts think it's due to an interaction between a pathogen introduced by European bumblebees and exposure to pesticides. The bee was added to the Federal Endangered Species List in 2017. As of this writing, there are 9 bees on the list, including 7 from Hawaii and a Western native, Franklin's bumblebee. Many more are on various state endangered species lists. Zerillo offered to show me some rusty-patched bumblebees held in the Agricultural Experiment Station's archive. The archivist brought out a box containing 23, some pinned to old labels filled out in fountain pen. Looking at each fuzzy body curled like a comma in its cardboard sarcophagus, felt like being at the graveside of a stranger I should have known. Not all native bees are as easy to keep track of as big, noisy bumblebees. An estimated 30% are picky foragers that use pollen from only one plant species or plant family. Others are finicky nesters that only settled down in sand, for example. These Goldilocks conditions exist in such a limited number of places that the bees have only been collected a handful of times. Indeed, about 1,000 of our native species are known by fewer than 20 cataloged specimens. The more specialized the bee, the more precarious its existence, and the more likely it is to need conservation. Finding these uncommon bees takes a certain kind of obsessive collector, a type Droege calls a beehead. He considers himself one. Beeheads, he says, are driven by a fanatical curiosity. They're the ones out hunting every day to see what they might find, or pulling over by the roadside to investigate what's buzzing around an interesting patch of weeds. They'll crouch by a plant or nest just to see who visits. Beeheads live for the thrill of discovery. When Droege announced the Andrena Rainey find, he knew that, of course, Michael would go looking into it, he said. Michael Veit is a retired high school biology teacher who lives in rural Pepperell, Massachusetts, and calls himself Bee Dude in his email address. He's long loved insects. They're just this really cool little package of life, he explains. He was focused on damselflies and dragonflies until about 2004, when he realized there were more than twice as many bees in Massachusetts, and there weren't nearly as well as studied. Veit collected the second specimen of a cuckoo bee called Nomada rhodecki ever found in America. He also found the Nomada rhodecki with two different species of Melitta bee, M. americana, which is a cranberry flower specialist, and M. melittoides, which is a maleberry flower specialist. His sightings help establish that there were hosts of the cuckoo bee. Discoveries like that really get you pumped up to go out and look harder, he said. Such beeheadery has made him one of Massachusetts' leading bee authorities, a co-author of a 2021 checklist of the state's 390 native bees. His tireless scouting of the state and talent for identification helped establish that five of the state's bees are imperiled, and he got them added to the state's list of endangered, threatened, and special concern species. I joined Veit last May to hunt bees in some of his favorite places. One was a shaded trail along a glittering trout stream in a nature reserve near his home. One of the reasons I'm so drawn to bee hunting is I get to visit beautiful places like this, Veit said. He's a trim, soft-spoken, and eager imparter of information. As he walked swiftly down the trail, scanning for bees and lifting his binoculars every so often to get a better look, he kept up a running commentary on the plants at our feet. This is a really nasty invasive plant called garlic mustard. It's a pretty good bee plant. And this, he said, pointing to a dainty purple flower, is an introduced species, speedwell, in the genus Veronica. It'll attract bees. And this is a native geranium, and it has a specialist bee that collects its pollen. Bee hunting is often as much about plants as about bees. And Veit picked this spot for a particular plant he found there, Golden Alexander, which has umbrella-like clusters of tiny yellow flowers. The flower is a host for a specialist bee called Andrena zizai. The first patch we reached was still in the shade, so there weren't any bees. Most bees prefer or even need the warmth of sunlight to be active. Veit began adjusting my expectations. When you find a specialist bee plant like Golden Alexander, there's no guarantee you're going to find a bee. But he barely completed the sentence when he spotted one. A tiny female dusted in pollen. Farther on, he pointed out several males, recognizable by yellow on their face. Ah, here's another female. She's cute. I could scarcely see the bees, much less the details he was clocking, but I was prepared to take his word on her cuteness. So I'm going to collect a few of these, he said, and swung his net with a graceful downward and upward swoop. And pinching it closed to hold the captives, he moved on to net some more. Veit keeps most of the bees he captures, unless they're boringly commonplace, like the fuzzy fat Bombus impatiens he'd released earlier from his net that day. The bee, easily found all over the East Coast, is one of the few bumblebee species that seem to be increasing its range and number. He transferred the bees into a glass vial with a chemical at the bottom that would kill them quickly. Back at the car, he put each bee in a film canister marked with a number. He then logged the number and the date, time, and plant on which the bees were found in his green field notebook. He has a stack of these notebooks in his office. He would use this data on the labels for specimens added to his collection. Some critics have objected to collecting bees that may be imperiled. Veit and others swat away the objection. There's no evidence that collecting any insect has an effect on the bug's population, they say. As one entomologist wrote, while it is extremely difficult to make a dent in most insect populations with a net, the bulldozer, the cow, and the plow eradicate whole butterfly colonies in no time. When Veit read Drogue's message about Andrena Rainey, he contacted the American Chestnut Foundation for advice on where to find chestnut trees. The group directed him to a number of sites, including Mount Ella in Massachusetts, where the forest canopy had been cleared by a freak tornado in 2011, opening up a space for remnant chestnut trees there to bloom. East Coast forests are still full of chestnut sprouts, just waiting for a break in the overstory, the tallest trees forming the top canopy that will allow them to drink up sun and grow. Alas, at some point, the blight inevitably reasserts itself and kills the stem again. Veit surveyed the chestnut groves in the summer of 2020 and found three female Andrena Rainey. That got me pretty excited, he recalled. Over the next 3 years, he and other beeheads returned to the site, as well as other places where there were chestnuts, hybrids, or chinqua pins, finding more of the bees. Since Andrena Rainey's rediscovery, it has been collected in at least five more states. The bee is clearly still around, but in low enough numbers that the Connecticut inventory lists it as a species of special conservation concern. The finds help confirm Drogue's initial hunch that Andrena Rainey is a specialist, reliant on chestnuts and their relatives. But if that's true, then what sustained this chestnut bee when the chestnuts disappeared? Was it other members of the chestnut family, or hybrids bred to help save chestnuts from oblivion? And how did these tiny insects, which can't travel that far, find their way to places like Mount Ella just in time to catch the trees in bloom? Add these to the big book of bee mysteries, Killingsworth told me. In the work that I do, there's always about five questions for every answer that I have. Drogue's Bee Lab has long been based in the Paxatunt Research Refuge, a site created in 1936 to support federal wildlife research. In 2019, he moved to a more remote and roomier part of the refuge, where endangered whooping cranes were once bred and raised. It held a ramshackle building and 30 acres of land. The main building is filled with bee-related art and quirky artifacts. An old library card catalog holds office supplies. A lane from an old bowling alley serves as a long central table. Old books with marbled pages hold up the shelves. The floor is orange with yellow painted slashes, the ceiling blue, and the walls hand-plastered with ochre clay. The bathroom is covered in mosaics, some made by his partner, who's an artist. Everything here is scavenged, Drogue says with pride. Aside from his salary, and more recently the salary of a lab manager, the lab runs on a shoestring budget of just $12,000, recently slashed from $20,000. The lab's most expensive piece of equipment is the camera Drogue uses to photograph bees. He uses a method of producing stunningly detailed portraits that reveal the beauty that otherwise can only be seen through a microscope. Drogue posts the pictures online to aid people trying to identify species. With more than 66 million views, it's clear his site is drawing those beyond the close world of beeple. One set of images captured more than 250,000 views after it was shared to a Reddit community called Whoa Dude. Drogue is one of a fewer than a dozen people in the country with the taxonomic chops to identify bees accurately. So many beeple want to tap that ability that he has amassed a collection of 200,000 specimens awaiting identification, stacks and stacks of white pizza boxes. Mondays are sacred bee days, where he works at home just identifying. And every Wednesday, he and a colleague from the lab hold a Zoom class teaching other beeple how to do it. At the same time, Drogue is modeling what ordinary people can do to help bees thrive. He has filled the land around the lab with unruly pots of plants. He walks through, stooping every so often to pull weeds. We need to grow a lot of plants of many different kinds, all kinds of obscure ones, he says. It's just so hard to catch, identify, process, and do surveys of bees. Really, it's better to concentrate on what plants the bees are using. Take the physalis, or ground cherry, growing by the lab's front door. There are four bee species that gather the plant's pollen, and at least one parasitic bee that preys on the nest of one of those specialists. So when it's in bloom, it's just a circus. But it's not on anyone's list of pollinator plants. That same logic drives a citizen science project Drogue helped create in 2021. Ask a bumblebee. Janan L. Hifnawi, a University of Maryland graduate student whom Drogue chose to run the project, told me, "We're trying to ask the bumblebees what flowers are their favorites. Although there's ample research showing which flowers bumblebees visit, there's almost nothing indicated which ones they like the best. To find out, they're having volunteers walk around for 30 minutes, recording every type of flower they see and tallying the bees they see visiting those plants. If the bees have 50 plants to choose from and they're only on 5, that tells us a lot." Al Hifnawi said, "Some answers have been surprising. For instance, it appears bumblebees don't care for some of the flowers contained in popular seed mixes, such as black-eyed Susans. The goal is to give people putting plants in everywhere, from public parks to highway medians to their own backyards, a list of plants that will draw bumblebees. That's the simplest part of the story. Maintaining diverse and pesticide-free habitats will go a long way toward protecting native species. After all, these creatures are at home here. If enough people fill their yards with the plants they want and need, the bees will show up, keeping our world in bloom for a long time to come." We'll finish today's program with a quick Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. And Patricia A. Ryan from Londonderry, New Hampshire asks, "Is it possible to know if woolly mammoths had some of the same social, caring personality characteristics as today's elephants?" Mammoths probably exhibited a lot of similar behaviors to elephants in terms of herd structures. Their diets are reasonably well known due to the findings in the digestive tracts of mammoth mummies. There's evidence that baby mammoths, like modern elephants, consume the feces of adults to develop the microbiomes they needed for digestion. There is some debated evidence of limited mammoth hunting by groups of humans. Like modern elephants, mammoths were probably dangerous enough to hurt an individual hunter. Genetics reveal that before mammoths became extinct, they grew isolated, most notably on Wrangel Island in the Arctic Ocean. That led to inbreeding. Yet genetics offer very little direct information about mammoth behavior. We still don't know enough about the expression of various genes in the elephant family to be able to infer how those genes shaped the behavior of earlier animals. That was Michael Campana, computational genomics scientist, National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.